token is distributed to users within the network, and that's where the value is provided from within the network. So there you're kind of eliminating the need for advertising in the first place.
Welcome to the JS World Podcast, powered by passionate people. Here we interview our speakers from the JS World Conference. We talk life, tech, and all sorts of things. Like what we have to offer? Like and subscribe. And don't forget to follow us on @JSWorldConf on Twitter. Anyway, Nader, hello. It's so nice to have you here again. It's been a very long time since you've been to one of our conferences to speak.
It has.
Yeah. So Luke came in with a fun fact this morning when we interviewed him, and he said, well, we were looking for Nader and we couldn't find him anywhere. And then apparently you were hiding in the audience.
I was in the audience. I was at the very top, you know, just chilling out, watching the previous talk, and then working on my slides over the break, you know.
So easy preparation to actually get up on stage.
Exactly. I just had to walk down.
Nice. So we've been here in the podcast room interviewing people, so we miss quite a few. Actually, we miss all of the talks. We get to talk to you guys afterwards. But apparently also you came up on stage, asked everybody to stand up, took a selfie, and that took the pressure off.
Yeah. I did a similar thing like 5 or 6 years ago when I was at another event, and it was pretty hilarious. And I figured it's been a long time. Maybe people don't remember. So I did the exact same thing this time.
Did it actually help with taking off the pressure?
Yeah, I think so. I think getting people laughing at first, you know, it's always a good thing. Kind of loosen things up.
Absolutely true. Yeah, nice. So we want to ask you a couple questions, if that's okay. I think one of the more interesting things is that you have been advising companies over the past few years, right? And you've worked for like the big names in tech. How has that been? What's that been like?
Yeah, it's been really fun because I've obviously been doing this stuff for a while, but for a while, early on in my career, it was hard for me to get any opportunities at all because I was a very early beginner, you know, without any traditional education. So to actually be able to go from there to working with companies like AWS, Google, and Microsoft, and most recently in the blockchain space, it's been really fulfilling, but it's also been, you know, a lot of fun.
Cool. And are you also working in the blockchain space in an advisory capacity?
I am.
Okay. So how does that look like? What does a day-to-day, or I should actually rephrase that, how does the day-to-day look like for you?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to kind of compare it to any other time in history and technology because I wasn't really around in the late 2000s, the late 90s, early 2000s, but a lot of people kind of that were there often compare the blockchain space to kind of that point in time where you have a lot of excitement, a lot of money, and a lot of opportunity, but the technology is still fairly new and nascent. So what you end up having is a lot of investment coming in and a lot of people with ideas and a lot of people wanting to build stuff, but not enough developers to actually get it done and not even enough people to actually get the job done. So you end up having people with a really great team of maybe people that are kind of founders, but they don't have the rest of their team built out, and they have the funding, but they don't have the rest of the team built out because there aren't enough engineers, there aren't enough people. And it seems like we're starting to see that in all parts of tech right now. It seems just like a really explosive time and growth. So you end up seeing salaries going up, making it harder to hire people or whatever. But I think the biggest thing that you see, though, is that these people do have a lot of capital and they're competing with everyone else. So you end up seeing really interesting like numbers with the salaries and stuff. So you're seeing really high offers. A lot of times people are getting offers, you know, in the six figures, obviously, as their base pay, but the actual equity that they're getting is often in the millions. And then on top of that, that equity is liquid. So you now see the opportunity where in the past people would have a traditional startup or FANG would be like, you know, often where you try to get to because you can have a really good salary and equity and stuff. And then with a FANG company, you would be able to cash that out at some point. But with a startup, you wouldn't. Now you have like a third category, I think, is like crypto and blockchain, where you have the good base salary, but you also have equity that is liquid, meaning that a year after you start, you can start selling and you know, having that money available to you.
That's cool. It's interesting. It's interesting it sounds like it's a bit of a shift in terms of how things are traditionally done, especially with young developers. So let's say ourselves, for example, looking for these opportunities. How would you say this landscape is evolving for young developers such as ourselves?
I think that most of the time, the older crowd, the quote unquote, you know, like boomers and even the millennials like myself, are more skeptical and often less likely to be interested in the stuff. But it's the complete opposite with the younger generation. They're already interested in digital ownership and digital assets. They've been playing Fortnite. They've been trading crypto. A lot of them have large crypto portfolios relative to the older generations. So when someone is presented with the opportunity to work at somewhere like Facebook or working at a new blockchain startup where they're making a lot of money either way, but in the blockchain space, they might like the culture a little better. They might, you know, be already interested in the technology. We're seeing it a lot easier to hire those types of people, the newer people that are coming into the space. And then it's that combined with the people that are already working at Fang often being pulled away to work on things that they see that are maybe more interesting or more meaningful or whatever. So it's like that combination. So it's we're drawing new people in from the older generations. We're seeing a lot of young people join, and therefore it's just creating more demand, I think, in the entire industry. You know, when you see a new sector pop up that has a lot of investment, you know, you're going to end up seeing the supply go down as far as engineering talent from all around the world.
I think the young, it's such a young like subsection of the whole industry, the blockchain. It attracts the younger people, it attracts this kind of maybe more risk-taking behavior as well. And what you see with the big corporations, usually they're quite risk-averse in that sense. So maybe they are actually pushed off from blockchain-related technologies, or maybe they are a bit more skeptical about that. That's probably something you also see in your work as an advisor for sure. On this kind of cases. How do you deal with that, like the skepticism of the big corporations on the blockchain, Web3?
Yeah, I would say that most of these teams have disruptive business models, and they don't really rely on any existing adoption for their network effects. Instead, they're kind of relying on other Web3 or blockchain projects or just brand new users coming in. And therefore, we often, you know, might see skepticism, but you know, at the same time, like, you have individuals within these companies that are skeptics, but those companies as a whole are actually creating strategies within them. So I gave a presentation at Google a few months ago to a team there that are interested in the Web3 space. They've also talked about and maybe even created their own roles within their company for blockchain. You've seen every payment company like Stripe and PayPal and all these other ones create crypto and blockchain or some type of related roles or even organizations. So I think one of the more recent ones was Square. Square created a blockchain and crypto area. So like all the payment providers, most of the big corporations have talked about adding some form of it there. So even if the people that are working there don't like it, they're essentially going to be working with it in the future anyway. So I think it's I think the more educated people become about the tech, the less polarizing it becomes, because people realize it's just like the internet was a new platform, a new primitive for us to do stuff with. It presents opportunities for people to do very bad things, like transmit harassment or even images that are illegal or some type of blackmail or sell drugs, whatever. We could literally list out thousands of things that the internet brings that are terrible. But at the end of the day, we realize that the overall benefit of it is good, and we can try to do things to kind of fight those negative aspects of it. So I think that is a way that you can look at the exchange of digital ownership with tokens and stuff. It allows people around the world to have access to financial infrastructure that they couldn't have in the past, but it also allows people to build out scams and stuff a lot more easily. So we just have to account for the negative and take advantage of the positive.
Mm-hmm. So the crypto space, of course, is like one area that, or one way of using the blockchain. I myself know the blockchain as I know how to write a Solidity contract, which is just about as far as I can go. So I basic stuff on the blockchain. But what else can you do with that blockchain? Because I'm sure it expands to much more than just, say, a Bitcoin or crypto financials.
Yeah, there's a couple of areas that I would categorize in the current movement of quote-unquote like Web3. And one of them is blockchain, which, in my opinion, only interesting part of blockchain is the smart contract technologies. I'm not really interested in Bitcoin or anything that only transmits value, because I feel like the real power is combining code with the transfer of value and being able to write business logic and stuff like that. So I think smart contract blockchains are really great and interesting, combined with peer-to-peer databases, which people often don't associated with Web3, but there was already a movement called the Decentralized Web that was really focused on decentralized databases, peer-to-peer databases. And then the other aspect, the third, would be this idea of self-sovereign identity and public key cryptography, being able to represent your identity with credentials that are not tied to your own personal email address and phone number that people can centralize and tie a lot of your browsing data and then leak it, and then you end up having a lot of problems. So the three things together that are really powerful about Web3 is this idea of peer-to-peer public databases, blockchains, and I would say identity, this new aspect of identity that we're talking about. And when you put those things together, you now have all of the technology that we've had in the past, and you have these new primitives that you can do stuff with. And I think when you start combining all of these things together, you just open the door to a lot of new types of applications that you can build. The earliest ones obviously have been finance. The ability to send payments in a single line of code, literally, you know, one line of code in Solidity, you can transfer value from one party to the other, is a complete, huge, groundbreaking type of change from what we've seen in the past with Stripe and all these other payment APIs that are pretty complex and rely on even more complex infrastructure to already be in place for those to even function. So having a protocol where you can just deploy a smart contract and transfer value in one line of code, that's obviously the fundamental groundbreaking thing about that introduced this technology. But I think down the road, some of the stuff that is even more interesting is having the combination of public data that's built on these peer-to-peer databases, having some type of way to index and provide querying capabilities on top of it, which is what we're working with at the Graph protocol. The protocol itself is enabled by blockchain technologies, along with self-sovereign identity, where people can actually interact with these applications without having to share their email address and their phone number. When you combine all those together, I think that's kind of really what excites most of us. And it's still fairly early on those. We do see some examples of applications that are already, you know, being used. But I think that we still have a lot of work to do before we see any existing, like social network, for example, be disrupted by one of these types of implementations.
So I hear you mentioning identity quite a few times now as a part of being or a part of Web3. I'm having a difficult time wrapping my head around the concept of identity in Web3, because to me, identity is, as you say, an email and a password, something that ties to me as a person specifically, or at least my online identity specifically. How does that work with Web3?
Well, as a developer, when we think about identity, we only care about your identity so we can enable functionality like authentication and authorization and data access control and things like that. So the only reason you typically ask someone for that information, if you are truly only care about the functionality of your application, is to allow them to be able to associate things with them and to be able to, you know, have ownership, quote unquote, of like a tweet or something like that. You know, you want to tie information to that user. But what we actually end up seeing are people like Google, for example, which again, they provide a great service with their search engine, but their entire business model relies on capturing everything about you and being able to sell that to other companies and exploiting, you know, that information that they've taken from you. They give you free email and all of that, and I love it. But at the same time, the reason that they're able to do that is because you are the actual product that they're selling to other people. And the reason that you're valuable is because they're looking at every email that you have and they're, you know, scanning it and they're getting information. So obviously, if you kind of like, if you've ever done anything like text message someone on WhatsApp and then open Instagram and seeing an ad for something, there's a reason that happens. It isn't because it's, you know, a coincidence. It's because they have all the information about you and they're kind of, you know, using it in that way. Some people are okay with that, but I would say the majority of people, once they've been exposed to a hack or a breach, or they've had their identity taken and they've had their accounts abused by people having credit cards under their names, those sorts of things, you realize that it's actually a massive concern, security concern, to have your information stored somewhere that you don't have control over it. Because every time you sign up with a new website with Google OAuth, they're storing your information somewhere. So by the end of the of 10 years of using the internet, your information is stored on thousands of servers. And all it takes is one of those to be breached. And everyone has already been probably breached. If you're more than a couple of years into using the internet, you've probably been involved with the data breach, whether you realize it or not. So the idea of Web3 identity relies less on me saying, okay, give me all of your personal information, and instead, okay, the core functionality that I care about is allowing you to authenticate, tying information to your identity in the sense of I want to be able to like associate a message to a user. And I don't really care how we associate that. We just want to associate it with some identifier. So we're going to use something like decentralized IDs, or we're going to use a wallet ID, what we call a wallet, which I could go into a little more detail in the sense of, like, I don't even like the term wallet. That's just kind of what we use, because an identity also can have value associated with it. So that was kind of the terminology they used early on. But yeah, so like all we care about, really, all we should care about is authentication and authorization. We shouldn't have to say, okay, for me to authorize you, you need to kind of give me your address and your phone number and your email and all this other shit. Like, no, we don't like that.
So how would that look like in a practical sense? Would you then just be a token?
You would have an ID, and you could associate your ID with whatever you would like. So you have a wallet address, and that address is kind of like your identifier. There are protocols out there, like Ceramic, that give you the opportunity to associate your address with your personal information if you choose to do so. So let's say you want to associate your Twitter handle or something to one of your identities, and each wallet address would be a separate identity. So therefore, you could have identities that you attach your personal information to, some you don't, it's up to you. But also instead of, again, them centrally storing that and then tracking all of the information that's happening as you browse their websites and do stuff, and them kind of like selling that to show you ads, the value proposition that a lot of these applications and protocols enable, or a business model where advertising is not even part of the equation, instead they're tokenized. So they have some type of token that works within a network, and participants within the network hold value, and then that token is distributed to users within the network, and that's where the value is provided from within the network. So there you're kind of eliminating the need for advertising in the first place.
Wow, this sounds like a super interesting concept. I think it adds more depth to at least my understanding of what Web3 actually is. Because again, as I said before, so crypto to me used to be, before our conversation, it's Bitcoin. It's I can write a smart contract. It's all related to value. But apparently Web3 is not at all specifically related to value.
Yeah.
What I find really interesting, though, is what you said, you can have multiple identities. So I could be address X, I could be address Y, I could be address Z, and then publicly address X could be connected to, say, a Twitter or a Facebook or whatever, and then my address Y could be completely anonymous, and I could use both at the same time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, imagine like 75-80% of the applications that you use, like you sign up, you want to sign up to like download maybe or pay a subscription to use some service, but like none of that service at all relies on them knowing your email address or your phone number or whatever information that you typically often would need to hand over. So like, how can we eliminate the need for that and therefore the security concerns around that? Then this kind of provides, but also what's really cool to me about it from perspective of a developer, that the actual user and developer experience of authenticating is actually made a lot easier. So you don't need to have a lot of this complex OAuth stuff and redirects and stuff for it to actually authenticate. Instead, all you need to do is sign a transaction using a wallet, which is essentially just pressing a button, having a drop down, you press a button, you sign a transaction with your private key, which is associated with you as a user. And then on the server, that could be verified just by having that transaction sent to the server with the wallet address. And then you have a decryption that's done. And the only way that can be decrypted is with the actual address or the public key of that user. So you end up having the ability to do authentication and authorization with just a couple of lines of code. And you don't need a lot of complexity on top of that. It's just that you just use a library like Ether's.js, use a wallet like MetaMask, and you're able to sign a transaction and then decode it on the server, probably just a couple of lines of code, I would say.
This is such a radical shift, basically. I also had the same image with the Web 3.0. For me, it was mostly connected with the cryptos, things like that, just the blockchain, but it sounds like a whole paradigm shift, basically, with the authentication, things like that.
Luke gave a talk focused just on identity that was pretty good, and I know you didn't get a chance to watch it because you all weren't here, but I would check out that talk, and that was a pretty good introduction to it. And also to underscore here, this costs nothing. It's completely free. There's no tokens involved. It literally is just more of a concept that's used within the blockchain space because of the nature of how the original smart contract network was built with Ethereum, and how it allows the authentication on the smart contract level with public key cryptography That's how it was originally implemented, but now we've been able to just, you know, actually take that and use it pretty much anywhere on the internet. And all you need to know is JavaScript to actually be able to take advantage of that as a developer.
The barrier of entry is relatively low then, if it's just JavaScript. I mean, lots of us know how to write JavaScript, just learning how to use JavaScript to actually do something in Web3.
Yeah, I have a tutorial on it, on how to implement sign-in with Ethereum. And I say sign-in with Ethereum very loosely. It really should be, actually, it might not even be called that. It might be called sign-in with a wallet. But essentially, it's just how to do this this idea of public key, signing a transaction with a private key and then decrypting with a public key.
I'm also interested in what you said before about business models, basically. Because this is going to necessitate some different kind of business model in the end. Because, yeah, like you said, if you're not paying for the product, you're the product. And it also gives us a lot of good things, like for Google, the free things they give for the email, but also the suite. I mean, we are the product, but they also give something in return. But this is going to require a whole different business model inside of Web3. Like, how's that shift? What kind of business models are you going to see in Web3 that weren't possible or weren't viable before in Web 2.0?
Yeah, it's completely different. It's a complete paradigm shift. And I think that's also part of the problem often when people start looking at this stuff. If it hasn't clicked for them, it just will not make any sense at all. But if you look at the most basic level of something that's already successful, a couple of examples are Ethereum itself. Ethereum is a protocol that has a token. And why does the token have value? Well, the token has value because of the utility that it provides by powering this network and people running the infrastructure. They help, I would say secure the network by providing the transactions and providing the proof of history and all the things that you need for this type of network to exist. You have the Graph protocol, which is what I work with, where we have people that are running the software infrastructure called Graph nodes that index information from the blockchain and serve it up via GraphQL queries. You have subgraph developers that, like me, that deploy APIs to this. And all of this is governed by a smart contract. So we're abstracting away like a bunch of employees that might have like need to like run and maintain like a code base, like an AWS or something. But instead we have a network of people that are participating and we have a token that runs. And, you know, part of the utility of that token is that it kind of is how the network is functions. So that's a good example. And we have, you know, a lot of users. We have billions of queries per day that are being used. We have billions of dollars of companies, you know, of transactions with companies per day that are using it because a lot of the DeFi protocols are using it. And then another final example is DeFi, and DeFi in particular is a great example of like how this might look in practice. Decentralized finance is essentially the idea of like abstracting away a financial service in a smart contract. So examples are Compound, Uniswap, Aave. They do lending, borrowing. They do different types of stuff that you might have gone to a bank for in the past, but instead they're just abstracted away with code. So if you wanted to build a $10 billion bank, you know, with that much transactions going on, you probably need, you know, a couple of buildings, a bunch of employees, you probably need to fly people around the world, blah, blah, blah. And we see smart contracts and protocols like together providing that much value with like 10 employees. So you're kind of like getting rid of the middleman by programmatically enabling financial services, you know, via smart contracts.
That sounds like an incredible shift. It this really reframes the whole Web3 thing. It really also reframes how I think about the current age of technology. So we are still traditionally Web2, if we could call it that way. So it's very much, as you say, we have all these chains available to us, like a financial chain, for example, with the bank, with the people, and that sort of thing. It sounds so wonderful that you can abstract all of that into a single smart contract that is ran by basically 10 people.
Yeah, and a good thing to point out is like we can't abstract away everything, right? Like there are limitations to where what we can do and where we are, but it's good for me to kind of also point out like just like we've had innovation that's happened over the course of the history. A new technology comes out, most of the time you're not kind of replacing everything that happened before. You often do have a fundamental like disruptive technology that does that, but for the most part, you're not. So when, you know, the internet came around and you start seeing people building different types of like legal services into the internet, you know, lawyers and stuff are like, oh, is this going to replace me? But instead, lawyers are now using different internet services to make their jobs easier and maybe make more money. we're seeing, you know, things like this happen all the time. Machine learning came out. Machine learning was an idea at first and people were hyping it up, but you know, it took a little longer for the use cases to get there. Now they're there, but we're not seeing someone say, oh, we're going to like use machine learning to completely replace this thing. For the most part, it has happened, you know, obviously here and there, but for those, for the most part, instead you're seeing people leverage machine learning to enhance the capabilities of what they had. And I feel like that's kind of where we're going with a lot of these technologies. Like banks are now, you know, taking advantage of smart contracts and using them. Yes, there are protocols that are completely replacing certain things, but I don't think that you're going to see the entire financial infrastructure be replaced. I think instead you're going to see like smart contracts are great for this and that, but we still need maybe traditional financial services for other things. That's kind of the way I look at these technologies in general. It's kind of like, oh, we can do new stuff now. Let's take advantage of those things for what they're good at and use the old things for what they're good at. And you know, that's the way I look at it.
I think it also opens like the discussion about regulation, like to be.
That's a big one. It sounds such a boring thing.
Like, yeah, you're on innovation and then someone comes along and says, yeah, but what about regulation?
Yeah.
But for real, like if you have 10 people that do something like some kind of lending or whatever, like there has to be some sort of.
Let me get the microphone right. So if I understand blockchain correctly, though, there is a very large part that is already self-regulated due to the nature of the blockchain, mm-hmm. because you have the entire network signing off on your transaction, which is your proof, basically. And you have different kinds of proofing, as far as I know. So in terms of regulation, you might be looking at government regulations.
But I'd be more like the what you mean with the blockchain actually doing the self-regulation on based on the mining, the voting, whatever, that only agrees on what happened, not if what happened was actually correct or if that's actually was something that has to, that's like legally valid.
In that sense, so you're bound to the regulations of the country and the laws that you have to adhere to then as much as, you know, the proof in the blockchain.
Yeah, I can lend you like $500 against 50% interest. I can do that, but that's kind of like...
Well, it depends on whether blockchain proof would be considered as a legal thing, wouldn't it? So if we use the example, for example, maybe you can shine some light on this because you of course are very much more knowledgeable about this subject than we are. Mm-hmm. Say he would lend me 500 euros at 50% interest rate, and we would actually put that down in the blockchain, right? Would that be legal? Or is that something that we should aspire to make that legal?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's being examined right now. Every country has its own regulations and ideas around how to regulate this stuff. But it's very challenging because by nature, it is permissionless. It doesn't need the U.S. government's permission to function. If they outlaw it, then it's still going to continue to run because the protocol itself is essentially just on a bunch of servers. That's a program running all around the world. So if I outlaw it, then I'm now kind of stopping innovation happening and maybe profits that could be created and then spent and taxed in other ways here in the United States. Or when I say here, I'm speaking of my home country, obviously. But so this is a very, very challenging thing. I think that we need to figure out the right regulations to make this happen and understand that it's going to be a different paradigm and a different way of thinking about it. Because if a country decides to outlaw it completely, then they are pushing away a lot of financial upside that other people are going to enjoy and take advantage of in other countries, and they're not going to see any of it. So I think that, you know, you can make a law to say, you know, in the United States, you're not allowed to do this. But all someone has to do is just open their browser and press a button and they're doing it, right? So there's no way to actually regulate it in the sense of like preventing it from happening. I just can't think of any way, you know? So like, it's going to be an interesting thing to see how they regulate this. And the United States is already starting to realize the opportunity here. And you see a lot of politicians that are kind of creating like legislation and stuff like that, that will help not only put the right regulations in place, but also give people the understanding that we are going to support this innovation. We just need to figure out the right way to support it, as opposed to other countries who are just trying to ban it, like China.
Okay, it was interesting. These are interesting times ahead of us, I think. It's going to be very interesting to see how Web3 is going to change how we do development. I mean, we were talking to Luke before we... We did Lucas, the second interview today. Yeah. And I remember we were talking to him, and he was telling about how he had an RFID tag in his hand, and how he's been in doing like Web3 and everything else that has to do with technology, from PCB design to like high level architecture to Kubernetes and whatnot, and server infrastructure, and even like data center infrastructure. And we were looking at each other. I feel old. I feel so old. But it's still nice to see like all these innovations, and then here comes Web3 again, and again. It catches me off guard. I feel old. Like, I feel stuck in, like, making buttons and, you know, making sure the colors are right and all these exciting things happening here. It really sort of, how do you say, it challenges the mind, you know? And it's super nice that we actually have the opportunity here to talk to you about this. So I'm very, very thankful for that. We have been going on for about 30 minutes. So I think we're going to have to wrap up because we have a lot of other people that we want to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for your time, Nader.
Thank you very much.
Generally, I want to say I'm coming out of this talk with a much better understanding of what Web3 is and what it can do. So I really want to thank you for that. That's super awesome.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And it's been a really great event so far. I enjoyed Luke's talk about authentication and everything like that on the same similar topic of Web3. So a couple of great talks still coming up. So I'm looking forward to seeing the rest of the talks. So thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening, and until the next one.